Welcome back to another episode of Seven Deadly Sinners. Thank you guys so much for listening, and I hope you're enjoying spooky season. We plan to have a spooky episode shortly before Halloween, but we're working on it. But today is a big one. Today is one of the ones that, if there was ever a topic that gets brought up more than anything else in our DMs and emails, it is the subject of this episode. So many of you have asked us why we haven't covered this story, and have asked us to do it. And I'm not sure why we've held off for so long in coming to you with this, but maybe because it's so well known. Maybe because its depth and breadth is so vast that it's overwhelming. And just when you think you've uncovered the last stone, you find a dozen more. It's been daunting digging into this content, not just because there's so much of it, but because it is so damn tragic and resulted in the deaths of scores of men, women, and their children in an absolute hellish way. And so, let's rip off the Band-Aid and learn everything we can about Vernon Wayne Howell. Vernon was born to a 15-year-old single mother named Bonnie in Houston, Texas, in the late 1950s. So I'm sure her pregnancy wasn't welcomed with open arms by her parents. She's 15. They ended up raising Vernon. He didn't meet his father until he was a teenager and lived a rather lonely childhood. Kids at school called him Vernie, and he was subject to bullying. He had incredibly poor eyesight as well as dyslexia, which I'm sure didn't help his grades. They were pretty terrible. Even being placed in special education classes didn't help him succeed academically, which ultimately led him to dropping out of high school in the 11th grade and becoming a carpenter. Pretty ironic if you ask me, in light of claims that he would later make. What he lacked in academic ability in school, he made up for with his propensity for music. He was naturally gifted in that realm, and in the spiritual one as well. Despite his dyslexia, he managed to memorize large portions of the Bible. By 12, he had memorized and interpreted the entire New Testament and became a born-again Christian at Southern Baptist Church, which was short-lived. I know some of you may be confused by this point. Who the hell is Howell? Who the hell is Vernon Howell? Well, you might know him better as David Koresh. For all intents and purposes, we will refer to him as such in the remainder of this episode. In his early 20s, he became heavily involved in his mother's church, a Seventh-day Adventist church. But church members were less than enthused by his presence. He was seen as overbearing in his attempts to convert church members to his interpretations of the Bible and religion, and gasp, he had long hair and dressed like a rebellious teen / early 20-something in the 1970s. He was unique like everyone else, as my dad would say. Eventually, though, after telling the pastor that God wanted him to take the pastor's 12-year-old daughter as his wife, David was naturally expelled. The pastor explaining it away to the church members as David being a bad influence on younger members of the congregation. But I'm sure the hope to marry a 12-year-old didn't help his cause, which is very disturbing. If only the congregation had a crystal ball to see this train wreck roaring down the tracks. And so, on to the next thing. David moved to Hollywood to pursue a rock and roll career, which how many cult leaders have we covered that have wanted to be rock stars? And we're going to hear a bit of his music in a second, but unfortunately for those he would meet years later, this rock star fantasy did not pan out. So he moved to Waco, Texas, of all places, in 1981. In Waco, David joined the Branch Davidians, a religious sect that had splintered from the Seventh-day Adventist Church. It was formed in 1935, just outside of Waco, by Victor Hotev, a prominent Los Angeles area Adventist who relocated to Texas after a book he had written upset church officials. He wrote that the church had become lax in their faith, which doesn't seem super upsetting, but all right, he was, extradited, that's not the right word, but you get my point. Victor believed the return of Christ was imminent, and that it couldn't slash wouldn't happen until a pure form of the church could be ready to receive him. So basically, Victor didn't think a church existed pure enough to receive the Messiah, especially not the Seventh-day Adventist Church. So he started his own that he deemed as worthy. The compound that formed in Waco started as a well-intentioned, semi-communal farm that began to unravel after Victor's death in 1955. His widow, Florence, took over the reins and moved the group to Mount Carmel, boldly proclaiming that the kingdom of God would arrive on Easter Day in 1959. Listen, I'm betting on sports right now on FanDuel, and, you know, that seems like a gamble, basically, being like, this is the day it's going to happen. But I guess you're just gambling on, people believing your bullshit and you being able to sort of, you know, confuse them afterwards or convince them afterwards that like, oh, no, it was, sorry, what I meant was Easter 1979, you got to stay here until then. Sorry, I'm dyslexic. But time and time again, it works. So that's one way to bolster a local community. Hundreds of believers across the country sold everything and quit their jobs, moving to Waco for the main attraction. And as you'd expect, Easter came and went, leaving Branch Davidians questioning whether the Messiah was, in fact, in the room with them. What happened next among the discouraged and distraught followers was deemed, quote, the great disappointment. Well, that's one hell of a way to lose your retirement. That is very sad. A core group of about 50 members stayed behind after the failed second coming of 1959. And naturally, there became a struggle for power. A charismatic man named Ben Roden eventually declared himself as the new leader. And at least for a time, things improved. At its height, the Branch Davidians topped 1,400 active members. When Ben Roden died in 1978, he was succeeded by his wife, Lois, who was quite taken with a certain young musician who would later be known as David Koresh. Upon his move from the Hollywood Lights, he kind of got her lit up. She encouraged the once aspiring musician to play guitar and sing during Bible study sessions at the Mount Carmel Center. Attendance at the church was starting to wane, maybe because Lois proclaimed that the Holy Spirit was feminine. I don't know. Anywho, Lois and Ben's son George thought he was the rightful successor and her heir to the Branch Davidians, which made him quite perturbed when he observed a blossoming relationship forming between his mother and the young musician. Now, just for fun, here's a clip of David singing from A Current Affair.
It's not hours of scripture. Vernon gets out his guitar and blasts his followers with a dose of doomsday rock and roll.
Run on!
The lyrics are about death and destruction, a surrounding army intent on destroying the cult. It was all so eerily prophetic.
See the armies sitting around the camps. You wonder who they are. See the armies sitting around the camps. You wonder who they are.
Louise's love affair with David began when she was in her late 60s, which is pretty scandalous. He would have been around 23 at the time, and how, pray tell, did he lock his cougar in? David confessed to members he was concerned about his excessive masturbation. And the story goes that Lois felt sorry for him, took him as her partner, and even tried to have a child with him. Which, listen, there's drugs and options now, but at this time, that was quite the stretch in your 60s. So I don't know what exactly they were teaching in sex ed at the time, but I think that that ship had sailed long ago. The couple traveled to Israel together, and upon their return, she began telling members to defer to David with any questions, which didn't sit well with George. In 1984, while still involved with Lois, David married a 14-year-old Branch Davidian named Rachel. He would have been 25 at the time. It's worth noting that the legal age of consent in Texas is 17. Rachel would go on to have two of his children, Cyrus and Star, during what he called 2 years of monogamy. She ultimately was his only legal wife. When Lois died in 1986, a major power struggle sparked between her former love and her son. Let's be honest, we are not shocked by this. George had been expecting to take over the sect when his mother passed, since she had stolen it from him allegedly in the first place, or so we thought. And David had been clashing with the members over his biblical interpretations that he called the serpent's root. George began wearing a gun around the compound, the first weapon ever seen on the property. He also changed the name of the compound to Roddenville. Very humble, very mindful, very demure. But what did the members want? Who did they want to see in charge, at least at this time? Well, they thought that George was nuts. On the flip side, they seemed to believe in what David was selling, that he was the seventh and final angel destined by God to bring about the end of the world. According to a news clip from ABC News, journalist Mary Garofalo, quote, "He claimed that he was a child. God had spoken to him and said, 'You're the chosen one. You are my Messiah.'" I meant to say when he was a child. "He claimed that when he was a child, God had spoken to him and said, 'You're the chosen one. You are my Messiah.'" But his story changed often. And perhaps David was just the more charismatic one. Maybe George didn't have that cult leader vibe in him. So hey, gotta be honest, some of us have it, some of us don't. I certainly don't. David had previously claimed that the world would end once he moved to Israel and converted Jews. Then he said a worldwide war would cause America to invade Israel, which would signal the beginning of the end. And only then would he be transformed into a, quote, warrior angel to cleanse the earth for New Jerusalem. But George was the only one they thought was nuts. He was the crazy one? Okay. He, again, probably just didn't have the charisma. Remember, David and Lois trekked to Israel in the 1980s. He was setting his sights on that prophecy. But that didn't pan out. The story changed once again, and instead, he scrapped Israel in the apocalyptic prediction and said this great battle would take place in Texas. That's a big change. Very convenient that they were already there, though. The end was nigh. Meanwhile, with all this prophecy and conjecture, tempers were still flaring between David and George, with George accusing David of setting a fire that destroyed the compound's administration building. David said the fire was merely an act of judgment from God to the organization. This didn't sit well with other members, meaning George supporters, that is. And George eventually drove David out at gunpoint. This led to David retreating with about 25 of his faithful followers to an eastern part of Texas, just outside the town of Palestine. And he was still in recruitment mode. New members continued to join the fractured organization, and David claimed to have a vision that he was the incarnation of the prophet Cyrus, who liberated the Jews from Babylon. Here's a clip from 1987 from Fox 5 describing the conditions of his makeshift camp. You'll hear his rock star guitar playing and singing, as well as David speaking to the media. He's a real trip.
But David says George stole the compound from the people who built it, and he took his followers to just outside Palestine, Texas.
There's some little children living in the cold, can't you see? And all the while, how can you turn your back on their plea?
There's people cold. My baby's been sick also. You see, I live in a bus, okay? Older people live in 8x12 shacks. Would you want your 83-year-old grandmother to be driven off a place where she'd put time and effort for 25 years, all because a guy thinks he inherited it?
Well, I hope you enjoyed that tasty little musical snack and his other ones, but he's still on one. So the group remained in Eastern Texas until 1987, when David returned to Roddenville with seven of his male followers. He had a plan. Or so it seemed. This is where the timeline gets a little hard to follow. George heard that David and co. were returning, so George made his own plan, a challenge. To resurrect the corpse of an 85-year-old woman. I know, it's getting weirder. He dug up her coffin, and David refused to participate. On Halloween, shortly after the incident, David contacted the sheriff's department asking to prosecute George for corpse abuse. The department thought it was a joke, given the date and lack of evidence. A few days after Halloween, David and seven followers entered the compound. They are decked out in camouflage and armed with semi-automatic assault rifles, shotguns, and 400 rounds of ammunition. Their alleged goal was to get photographic evidence of the corpse for the sheriff's department. Did they bring a camera? They waited until the majority of women and children had left for work and school, and then traveled from building to building, warning members to leave, just in case there was a problem. Of course, there was. A gunfight ensued behind the Roddenville fences and between the barricades, and Louise's dear son, George, was shot in the chest and hands. A sheriff was called in and the shooting stopped. George survived. David and his trigger-happy gang were put on trial for George's attempted murder and released on bond. They were acquitted after a mistrial. David claimed he was aiming for a tree, not George. I don't know if we believe that, but again, charismatic cult leader. He also told the jury that the group went to Roddenville looking for evidence of corpse abuse and had aimed their shots at a tree to scare those living in the compound. Okay, but hey, at least for his sake, some members of the jury bought it. During this time, George was arrested for contempt of court in an unrelated case. He was released from jail on contempt charges and moved to Odessa. Meanwhile, George was then sent to a state mental hospital after being convicted of the murder of Wayman Dale Adair. He claimed that David had sent the man to kill him. He would later manage to walk away from the Big Spring State Hospital, Big Spring, you got it, Rachel, and go missing for 4 days, only to be returned to the facility by Texas Rangers. George escaped the facility several other times, once being caught outside the Israeli consulate in New York City, and later when he was found dead of a heart attack on the grounds of the hospital at age 60. He was nothing if not persistent. This story is so wild. This is 100% going to be a two-parter, and I hope you're on this journey with me. So when George no longer in competition for the leadership role, David assumed this position. And this was when he legally changed his name for, quote, publicly and business purposes. Why the name David? Well, he believed that he was not only a prophet, but the head of the biblical house of David.
She's the only one for you.
According to a PBS article, Koresh is a Hebrew translation of Cyrus, the name of the Persian king who allowed the Jews held captive in Babylon to return to Israel. And remember that vision he had while living in East Texas about Cyrus? Roddenville's name was eventually changed back to Mount Carmel during this time. And all the while, more and more recruits were finding their way to the Texas prairie and the promise of salvation. And they came from all corners of the globe, from Hawaii to Great Britain to Australia. And like so many impressionable cult followers that we have studied over the years, they gave Dave their worldly, or David, sorry, like we're buddies. Hey, Dave, can I call you Dave? They gave David their worldly possessions and hundreds of thousands of dollars. I'm not sure if any of them were aware that he was a high school dropout, but it didn't seem to matter. His biblical knowledge was impressive. He was persuasive, very persuasive. And he had that charisma, that chutzpah, that drew people in. Locals said David was a regular guy that would turn up in town to listen to live music. He would often be seen with very young women. One Texas sheriff, Parnell McNamara, told People magazine that he was kind of a village idiot. I couldn't believe that people would look at that guy and want to follow him anywhere. He was the local goofball. But what the townsfolk saw in public, life at the compound was very different. There were rampant allegations of child abuse. Followers claimed he would beat even the youngest of children until they were bleeding and covered in bruises. David always denied these claims, and child welfare representatives would visit the compound and would find no wrongdoing, but some claimed David always seemed to know when they were coming. Why does this always seem to be the case in most of the cults we've covered? And then things ramped up. After the fallout with George, an armed guard was always stationed on the compound's perimeter, and their fearless leader had ultimate control. And that control meant manipulating followers to do his bidding and grow increasingly wary of the impending second coming. Years and years worth of provisions were stockpiled, and ammunition and guns were stored in the compound behind a locked door that only David had a key to. A bus was buried in the ground to serve as an entrance to the bunker. And we're not even talking about just one-star accommodations here. The compound had no running water or heat or electricity. Okay, well, this is just making me feel a little self-conscious about where I live. We are getting running water, but we still have to haul it in, but I get it. Okay, actually, Kate wrote the script. Kate's a doll. She's back on board writing scripts, and I think she's done a damn good job. Damn good job. And I've always wanted to do this case, but Kate, I'm feeling a little sensitive here right now, but joking. But anyways, members were expected to attend Bible study 3 times a day. And like many cults we have discussed in past episodes, followers were instructed how to dress and what to eat. No makeup or jewelry for women. Members were told where and when to sleep and to abstain from sugar, processed foods, and dairy, because dairy is made from milk, which he considered a baby food, and they were adults now. And eventually, par for the course, David was now the only man allowed to have wives. Every other marriage was annulled, though not legally. You see, David had also tweaked his teachings to include the practice of spiritual weddings. Because what cult leader doesn't like having, you know, the ability to sleep with multiple wives? He told followers that God told him to build a house of David with many wives, just as King David had done. There was Robin, 17, who shared a son, Sean, with David. Then there was Robin's mother, Janine, age 50. There was Dana Okamoto, who gave birth to a son, Sky, and later told ABC News in 2003 that the children were kept in line by a wooden paddle and faced severe beatings for minor infractions, like spilling a glass of milk. Well, he hates milk. It's sad, though. And it gets worse. She said that she remembered being so under Koresh's control that she beat Sky until he bled. She said, if there was one thing I could take back, I would take back the spankings. I felt like the most evil person in the world to be beating my baby this way. But this was what God wanted and needed from me. And then, like many of the cults we've covered, the families began to be separated from each other, because David worried children had a stronger bond with their mothers than him. The wives continued to get younger and younger, and David began to hand children over to be raised by different mothers to deal with his bonding issues. He married siblings as young as 12. It is alleged that he had as many as 20 wives over the years, some of whom were far under the Texas legal age of consent. He fathered at least a dozen children with Branch Davidian members, that many may have still been legally married to their cult husbands. When women, or girls I should say, were chosen, they would wear a Star of David pendant as a symbol. According to a Newsweek article from mid-March of 1993, when the ex-husband of one Branch Davidian heard that his 10-year-old daughter was wearing the star, he sued for custody, and after winning, whisked her away to his home in Michigan. And other couples followed suit. And this is where we are going to end part one, because it's getting pretty heavy, and I don't have electricity either. Well, we got solar power, and I'm sweating profusely, and I want to make this good. Kate did a great job on the script. I'm enjoying this. I hope you're enjoying it as much as I am. And yeah, follow Kate Codman on Instagram. She's a, well, Seattle Caitlin on there, but she did a great job. This has been also wonderful to have a quick break from writing a script. I don't think she's written one in like 6 months or something, but I always enjoy when she does. She's a great writer, journalist, and so thank you, Kate, and thank you guys so much for listening. And if you're enjoying the show, please leave a 5-star rating and positive review on Apple Podcasts. And I love you. Thank you for always being here, always being cool. And yeah, this is a big one. I know that Greg and I got super into the scripted series about Waco. He was like some teen star that played David Koresh, like someone that was like too pretty to probably play him. I can't quite remember, but it was good. So this is a very, very interesting story. So hope you guys are enjoying, and I'll see you next week.
George says you're a warlock and that you have the sign of an upside-down cross on your chest, and that's the sign of a warlock. You've studied Satanism.
I never was involved in Satanism, but you can see I'm a musician. You see, the guitars and stuff. There was a time in my life where I was seeking after Christ and all that, and I had come to the end of my rope in life, and you know, what I did was is that I took a five and dime store across and all that, and I was there mounted with a candle, you see, and it fell on my chest.
Back in November of 1987, 8 heavily armed Koresh followers in battle fatigues advance on a desolate church compound called Rodenville, just outside of Waco, Texas. They're met by a gun-toting preacher named George Roden.
There's 2 or 3 of them over there by the house, and that's where I asked them who they were and what they wanted, you see. And so when they answered, they started shooting. So that was the answer I got from them.
When the smoke clears, George Roden is rushed to the hospital with a flesh wound. The 8 suspects are rushed off to jail. The charge, attempted murder. More than a dozen high-powered guns and hundreds of rounds of ammunition are seized. It looks like a throwback to the days when Waco was known as Six Shooter Junction. But as sheriff's deputies search the grounds, a bizarre tale of power and prophecy, greed and guns, begins to unfold, with David Koresh at its center.
Please, please, please. Jackson. It's not what it appears to be.